All right. So today this midrash was purposely placed on the first day of the feast because it's going to be, in some respects, a follow-up to the teaching we just completed on who we are in Israel. And many of you already knew who you were, but we have some new people and we wanted to kind of go through that and really read the scriptures on who we are as spiritual Israel. So it's Holy Week right now, and as we reflect back on what happened almost 2,000 years ago, we're always torn through this week between the somberness of what happened, but the joy of what happened when he came out of the grave. And we're going to get to kind of experience that as we go through the week. And one of the things that I'd like to encourage you to consider doing is just each and every day this week up until Saturday afternoon when the resurrection would have happened, just think about what was going through the disciples' minds. You know, they spent his entire ministry, however long that was, they spent that time studying with him and he was teaching them everything. And they still kind of were left a little perplexed at the end. And while he was in the grave, I can't even imagine what was going through their mind. Everything that they expected of him didn't seem to be playing out the way they were hoping it would be playing out. So I encourage you, just reflect on that. Go back and read the story in the four Gospels and reflect on what they must have been going through. Because we clearly know what they probably went through when they saw him again for the first time. But we don't know what they went through. And I'm not saying you're going to find that out. Maybe the Father will reveal it to you. But I have to believe it was a pain and an anguish that we may never know in this lifetime. They were walking with the King of Glory. So as we go through this study today, we realize that many people across the globe, Jewish people, Christians, people of different walks of faith, many of which use a Bible or a form of the Bible, they have not had their eyes opened yet to the truth that I think everybody in this room has already been experienced. Or has experienced. So how did they witness all the things that Yeshua did, either at that time or having heard about it throughout history, and not recognize him as the Messiah? And the answer is what I hope we'll get to today, and we're going to allow everybody to talk about this, because really the topic today is who is the Messiah of the Old Testament. And so to get started, I'm going to let Laura introduce a question and an idea to you, and then we will just go right into open questions and answers and discussion. Laura?
Tom had talked about that this was going to be the topic today, and I found some quotes that I thought were really interesting and really pertinent to this concept. So I'm going to start off with a quote from Maimonides, and you may have heard that name. You may have also heard him called Rambam. He's a very, very famous rabbi. And he said that any individual who does not believe in the coming of Mashiach or does not await his arrival is rejecting not only the prophets, but the Torah and Moshe also. For the Torah promises us regarding his arrival in Deuteronomy 30. It's one of the verses that I read the other day, that Yahweh your Elohim shall turn back your captivity and shall have compassion on you. He shall turn back and gather you from all peoples where he has scattered you. You're driven out the farther parts of the heavens. It says that he'll bring you to the lands that your fathers possessed. And Judaism has considered this a prophecy of Messiah in the Messianic age since these verses were written. And there was an author who wrote an excellent article that they were talking about this quote from Maimonides and what does it mean. And what they said was that two of the fundamental tenets of Judaism are the belief in redemption and the belief that the dead will be resurrected. So they believe that it's about the world being set right under Yeshua, and it's set, or under the Messiah, and that the truth of the Torah will be self-evident, that Judaism will no longer be simply a religion, but it will be a covenant with all people, that redemption is a belief in the supreme truth of the Torah itself, is the Jewish perspective on redemption and resurrection, that it's the belief that the Torah is actually what he said it was, and that it will be patently obvious to everyone on earth But that he says, Maimonides specifically said that it's not sufficient to just believe in the coming of Messiah, but that you have to be awaiting his arrival. That there is a fundamental Jewish principle, and it existed at the time Messiah was born and the time he lived, that if you are not yearning for Messiah's arrival, it's demonstrating a lack of belief. So even the Talmud teaches the Jewish people that you're going to be asked on the Day of Judgment, did you yearn for redemption and the return of Mashiach? So taking all those things into consideration, if the attitude of Judaism has been to yearn for redemption and eagerly await the Messiah, how on earth did they miss him?
Yeah. Absolutely. Anybody else can jump in.
No, please go ahead. Yeah. I mean, because that's.
It is, and it's interesting because I was always curious why did they think he was going to come before the end of 4,000 years from creation? Because that's a very common teaching in Judaism, at least in Orthodox Judaism. But I couldn't find a scripture in the Bible that said that. I mean, I'm not saying it's not there, but I couldn't see it. It turns out it's more of a rabbinical study of the word and a decision they kind of made. But I mean, you got to face it, the people that have more time on their hands than me state and they list that Yeshua fulfilled over 300 prophecies of the Mashiach. Now, I will grant you some of those are vague, but he fulfilled them. But some of them are extremely specific and he still fulfilled them. So, there's no order today of how we're going to go through, but does anybody have any ideas to share on how they missed him? Rhonda.
According to Matthew chapter 2, it seems that they knew the prophecy of Micah that said that he was going to be born and shed light on him.
Yep.
And that comes from Micah 5:1-2. And so at first I was thinking that we should know the prophecies. We should read the prophets and know what they are saying. But then I thought, well, they knew this prophecy, but they still didn't see it. Mm-hmm. And, well, one thing is they had their own preconceived idea of where he was going to come from. And I didn't write all these scriptures down now. It says, Herod asked them, he called them to get together all the head Kohanim, the priests, and the Torah teachers, and the people, and asked them, where will the sign be born? They had left them. They answered right away, and they quoted the prophet. So he sent them out. So then he sent them to Bethlehem and with these instructions, search carefully for the child, and when you find him, let me know, so I do not go worship him. But then in John 7, let's see, doesn't the Tanakh say that the Messiah is from the seed of David and comes from Bethlehem, the village where David lived? And so I went to that's from 2 Samuel 7:12. But anyway, let's see, I don't remember what 2 Samuel 12 means.
2 Samuel 7.
Said, when your days, so this was another prophecy, when your days come to an end and you sleep with your ancestors, I will establish one of your descendants to succeed you. One of your own flesh and blood, and I will set up his rulership. So, again, there was another prophecy. They knew that it was going to be a descendant of David, so somebody from Judah. So, and I didn't get a chance to look this up, but there's somewhere in one of the prophets it says that they didn't believe because they didn't prepare their hearts. So even though they knew the prophecies, they had unprepared hearts. So I was thinking that I'm going to start asking now to prepare my heart. Whatever that might mean, so I'm going to let him do that. But I'm going to start asking him to prepare my heart so I don't miss
in Bethlehem. Isn't the verse that you're talking about, they're saying he couldn't be. Well, I mean, there's somewhere.
Right.
Well, because he was born, raised in Nazareth.
Because he was from Nazareth, right? And they say, has anything good ever come out of Nazareth? So they didn't know he was actually born in Bethlehem. So I think having all of that head knowledge to, you know, they knew he was going to be born in Bethlehem.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
So,
yes.
But they didn't know that was actually fulfilled. And so, if their heart had been right, it wouldn't have mattered that they didn't see the fulfillment, because I think that there's things being fulfilled in prophecy every single day that are concealed from us. And so if we're like leaning on our eyes' ability to see and interpret those things that we're watching for, we're going to end up just like the Pharisees. I mean, not that we're not supposed to be watching for prophecy, but it terrifies me, the idea of how many people would nitpick the legitimate return of Messiah based on debatable matters and their pet doctrines, if that's even possible. I don't think, hopefully it won't be possible. Hopefully it'll be too obvious.
I don't believe they were supposed to see it.
Yeah.
If we're talking about them as Judah, who was still living in Israel, the work wasn't finished. Prophecy, almost all of prophecy, talks about Israel.
Yeah.
You know, not Judah.
Yeah.
So they weren't supposed to see Jesus. Jesus came for us. He came for Israel. Yeah, absolutely. He really didn't come for Judah.
That's right.
So all of the prophets teach that.
Yeah.
You know.
That's a good point.
Over and over again. So that they missed it, I don't think they missed it at all. I think it was part of the plan.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was deliberate. They were never supposed to see it.
Mm-hmm. Although a great many did.
Some did.
Yeah.
Some. But and even having said that, though, the disciples, so many of them, and this is another thing, this was pretty well common knowledge, common so much that a religion was created around it. The disciples died violently because they wouldn't simply say, hey, you know what, it was a fake. The whole thing was a put-up job. Jesus never did any of that stuff. All they had to do was just say, nah, I recant. And, you know, it's a whole bag of whatever. It's malarkey. It never happened. None of them did. And they were tortured. They were burned. They were crucified upside down. All but one, I believe, John.
John. They tried to kill him.
But the long and the short of it, the world saw the steadfastness with which they stuck to the story.
Mm-hmm.
And they died. All they had to do was deny.
Yeah.
And they didn't. They suffered incredibly at the Circus Maximus, at Maximus and the other places in Rome.
Yeah.
It was made a spectacle of it. And everybody was so impressed with the idea that even unto death, these guys stuck to the story.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to suffer and die for something that's made up.
Yeah.
Think about it, you know? Nobody.
It's true.
Yeah.
And so I don't believe that Judah, I don't believe that they were ever supposed to see what was going on.
I have a question on that, because we know that Judaism teaches two messiahs, right? And some sects of Judaism believe it's two separate people, and some believe that it's embodied in one person. But they never taught at any point that it was two comings of one person. So if future faith in the Messiah saved the patriarchs, then does the current faith in the future coming of Messiah ben David, which is who Judaism has been looking for all along, if they were never supposed to see Messiah ben Yosef,
yeah,
then is the hope unto the return of Messiah a criterion for salvation? If the hope unto the first coming of Messiah was a criterion for salvation?
Very good question, and way over my pay grade.
Is it possible? Let's say, is it possible? I don't know.
Absolutely. I've thought about that a lot over the last year, to be honest with you. If they are walking out, I mean, the New Testament, Paul writes somewhere that even those who don't know the Lord and they do his commandments just by nature, I can't imagine if you're doing everything right and you just didn't know his name. You know the redemption comes from God, because it says right in the Bible that salvation comes from God. Yeshua was the sacrifice. So that's a very real possibility.
The whole thing, the way it was set up is, because we're about to, in this high place in the Torah study, right?
Mm-hmm.
His glory filled the temple, and the next Torah lesson we're going to be on, that Aaron goes in and, him and Moses are called into the tent after the 7 days of priest ordination. And then, with all the talking out and stuff and the 400 years of silence, they missed the part that Yahweh was supposed to be with them. His presence was supposed to be. And so everybody missed the calling. I mean, they'll send troops of people out there looking for the next red heifer, but they're missing the birth of the Messiah. They aren't really seeing it. They aren't tracking it. They hear the story and then they give up.
Right?
And it's just the same thing with his parents. It tells us in Isaiah 11, there shall come forth a rod from the stem of Jesse, a branch shall grow out of the roots. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, and a spirit of wisdom and understanding, and a spirit of counsel and might, and a spirit of knowledge in the fear of the Lord. These will all be upon the Messiah.
Right.
Well, we see, really, he had that at a real young age. In Luke, when he's 12 years old, he goes to the temple. And a child grew and became strong in spirit and filled in wisdom, and the grace of God was upon him. His parents went to Jerusalem every year, the feast of Passover, and when he was 12 years old, they went to Jerusalem according to the custom of the feast. Okay, so that's his time of year. And when they had finished the days as they returned, the boy, Jesus, lingered in Jerusalem, and Joseph and his mother did not know it. But supposing him to have been in company, they went a day's journey and sought him among their relatives and acquaintance. So when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem. Now, so it was after 3 days, kind of ironic, right? They found in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teacher, both listening to them and asking questions, and all who heard him were astonished at his understanding and answers. So when they saw him, that's his parents, they were amazed, and his mother said to him, "So son, why have you done this to us? Look, your father and I have sought you anxiously." And he said to them, "Why did you seek me? Did you not know I must be about my father's business?" So he's doing this at 12.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, in the book of John, they're looking at him, "Aren't you the carpenter's son? How do you know all these things? You're uneducated," basically, is what they're telling him. So not even his parents recognized him, the way I see it.
I was going to say that we have a Jewish friend, and this is what his take on Messiah is. He says, if Yeshua is the Messiah, when it is revealed to him, when the Messiah comes, and he is fulfilling the prophecy of restoring the nation of Israel. He will believe that Yeshua is the Messiah. Right now, he just can't see it.
Right.
Isn't it a faith kind of thing, though? You know, he needs a sign to believe.
Because he's going by what the prophecy is saying.
Even the disciples asked him. The disciples said, when Yeshua, because they come to believe that he was the son of Elohim, and he said he was going to leave, and they asked him, are you now going to restore
the kingdom to Israel?
That's Acts chapter 8.
Because that's what the sages have always taught. You're looking for a Messiah to do. And they didn't understand that the kingdom of heaven, the spiritual, had to be restored first. So they've always said there was going to be a messianic age, but they didn't understand that the messianic age is a spiritual kingdom, because they were expecting the temple to be rebuilt, the king to be on the throne, gold in the streets, and
the Romans put down the feet.
Right.
Trump. Right.
Well, and one of the other things that Judaism teaches that's really problematic, because what you were saying, Tom, about the people looking forward in faith, understanding that salvation is from Yah. And Judaism has turned into such a works-based religion, such that they don't teach that salvation is based on works. A lot of people think that they teach salvation is based on works. What they do teach is that the messianic age is going to be instituted when a certain amount of righteousness in the earth has been achieved.
Right.
So as in enough Jewish people fulfilling enough commandments or doing enough good deeds is going to usher in the return of Messiah.
Exactly.
So like one more person doing one more good thing has the potential to usher in the return of Messiah. And I found that in a number of places. Yes.
I think really it's clear too that the Jewish opinion about the Messiah has changed over the years. And the reason why is I'm going to read you two documents that I found when I was studying for this afternoon. I just found these. Because it regards that, my question, why did they think that, you know, at the end of 4,000 years he was going to come? Well, in the Talmud Sanhedrin 97, it's recorded that Tana Deba Eliyahu teaches the world is to exist 6,000 years. In the first 2,000, there was a desolation, no Torah. It is a tradition. Now, this is what he wrote. I'm not teaching here. I'm just reading this. It is a tradition that Abraham was 52 years old when he began to convert men to the worship of the true God. From Adam until then, 2,000 years had elapsed. 2,000 years, the Torah flourished. And the next 2,000 is the Messianic era. The Messiah will come within that period. But through our many iniquities, all these years have been lost. He should have come at the beginning of the last 2,000 years, but the delay is due to our sins. Now, this is a rabbi who was at least highly enough regarded to be recorded into the Talmud, which is no small feat, as most of you well know. But I want to read this other one, an article in the Jewish Press newspaper in Brooklyn, New York, by Rabbi Shalom Kloss, entitled The Coming of the Messiah, and he explained that there were very high expectations among the Jewish people for the Messiah's return during the first century. And he wrote, the belief in a personal Messiah has reached its highest tension during that period of the first century when Rome sent her despotic procurators to rule over Judea. The yoke was most oppressive, and the Jews awaited a leader whom God would send to articulate their latent spirit of rebellion and free them from the Roman tyranny. So it isn't scriptural at all, but they, through study of the scripture, understanding the 6,000-year plan, the 1,000-year millennial, they had determined that he was going to come. And they, in my humble opinion, were correct. He did come at the very end of that 4,000-year period. They just didn't recognize him because, as we've talked about, one of the real possibilities, he didn't fulfill all of the prophecies that Messiah has to fulfill to be Messiah. Now, we obviously trust and believe that he's going to do that when he returns. That will, we will be proven right or wrong when that happens. My faith is we will be right. But with that in mind, I want to kind of move to the second question, because they changed their mind after they, you know, Bar-Kokhba was kind of the last one they really put their hope in. And then they realized, well, he ain't coming at the time we thought he was coming. So they put an adjustment on it, and they're now looking for the Messiah that is clearly coming at the end of 6,000 years, which is what we talked about the last few weeks on the latter times. So I want to discuss this real briefly. There's one real key event that has to take place prior to that happening, to the second return of our Messiah. What they're looking for is the first return of their Messiah. Does anybody know what that is or want to talk about what has to happen? No, no, it's a war. It's the war of Gog and Magog. It's found in Ezekiel 38. And far as I could find studying, there's no scholar on Jewish scholar that does not believe that that has to transpire prior to the coming of the Messiah, or for us, the return of the Messiah. And that's Ezekiel's war. Now, I guess with that, the main thing is let's talk about the scriptures that justify their, or at least gives them reason to believe that Yeshua is not the Messiah. And the question would be, well, what's the Messiah going to do when he comes back? What do the scriptures say the Messiah? And this is where I'm hoping some of you did a little homework. Mark.
This may seem a little random, but a Jewish friend that we know that's a guy over in Israel, he told me one time that there's a bunch of, it's him, but not just him, but a bunch of people who believe that the Messiah will drive a tank up on the Mount of Olives and get out after a victory over the war.
Okay.
So this is, in their eyes, that's going to be somebody that looks like you and I. It's going to get out of the tank. You know, that's who they're going to expect. That's what they're expecting in Messiah. But anyway, that's
Anti-Messiah.
Just
Messiah. That's setting up
Anti-Messiah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's another thing that is going to be before. But one of the scriptures, I don't know if I'm getting ahead of us right now.
There is no order.
Scriptures say that when he returns, Yeshua is saying, will I find faith on the earth? Well, that's going to be about like it was on his first coming, because in John, and this goes back with what other people have said, but there's scripture to back it up. Yeshua's talking in John 5. Let me see, I'm going to start at 46. It says, for if you really believed Moshe, or had faith in Moshe, but they don't, Israelis don't really look at things abstractly, so that's, belief means action involved. But if you really believe Moshe, you would believe me, because it was about me that he wrote. But if you don't believe what he wrote, how are you going to believe what I say? So, we also read, Paul says that faith comes by hearing the word, right? Well, at this point in time, the Talmud is in the process of being formed. It hasn't been all the way written yet. That'll be in Tiberius a time later. But they were involved in building fences around the Torah, around the Word. So, basically, because of the Talmud, they could not get to the straight, pure, simple word Torah. So with that fence or that barrier around the Torah, that would tend to put blinders on people that are paying attention to the barriers, but not the Torah. See what I mean? So if you don't, if you're not looking at the scriptures, then you can't have the faith that you had mentioned. So it was not so much. Yes, I really agree with a lot. The Jews were supposed to not see him, but this—that's the mechanism. One of the mechanisms why they couldn't see. Not the only one, but I say one of the mechanisms.
Yep.
And so it's like, okay, that has to be happening right now to us, right now. There's some things that are prophetic happening, you know, or in the process of being set up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, are we going to be participants of it, or are we going to be ones who nitpick and put it down?
Yeah.
When I look at what could be happening today, I kind of see what actually happened back then.
Mm-hmm.
For an example, if Ephraim or Joseph is supposed to be reforming as a nation, there's so many people that are totally against that. And
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the beginning of that. Nation that is supposed to be reforming, what was it?
The northern tribes started to be reconstituted, not just here, but worldwide, and we see that it is. But there's a lot of people in leadership that are poo-pooing that whole idea. Now, why would they poo-poo it? Well, for one reason, what's in it for them? You know, if you're going to have to sidestep something greater than your own ministry to let something greater go by, well, there's a lot of people that don't want that to happen. The Jews at the time, they were involved in something that had been forming 400 to 500 years. It wasn't all the way, but this was an investment. This Talmud was an investment. They weren't willing to just sidestep that and let the light that Yeshua was trying to shine free everybody. So they were basically going from one bondage to another. And they were in bondage to the Romans. 1,500 years earlier, they were in bondage to Pharaoh. Is that going to repeat? Maybe we're in a bondage that we don't even know because of the cross and a warm bathtub. You don't even know. So anyway, I just wanted to set that.
I think what Rhonda just said before is really perfect for what you just said. I'm going to ask Yah to prepare my heart.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I don't want to miss it. I don't want to be one of those people who say, oh, no, you're doing it wrong, or you're not doing it the same way we did it. Or just prepare my heart so that the truth would be what we would see, mm-hmm. not the nitpicky stuff.
Being busy about all the nitpicky stuff. Absolutely. That's awesome.
What you said about faith, that Maimonides quote, he said that to not be looking eagerly toward the coming of Mashiach is a lack of faith. And I think that ultimately, like, the answer to the question, I mean, we can talk about the different ways that lack of faith manifested in the first century, and then how that reflects on how it manifests in us as believers now. And I think that's the ultimate question, is that the reason they missed Messiah, or the ultimate answer to that question, was that it was a lack of faith, because what you're talking, the verses that have been quoted, and interestingly, what you quoted, Tom, about that they thought that he did not come because of their sin. But Romans says that all that is not faith is sin.
Right.
So we have 1 John that says sin is lawlessness, so sin is transgression of the Torah. And you have Romans that says anything that is without sin, or anything that without faith is sin.
Sin, yeah.
So technically, you could be keeping every single command in the Torah, if you're doing it for the letter of the law and not with faith,
right.
It's not.
I think that's Isaiah's prophecy, right?
Yeah. And so I think that all plays into, because you were asking about the various things that Messiah is supposed to do, that Messiah is supposed to do prophetically, but we have almost as many prophecies about what the condition of the people is going to be as we do of the things that we're looking for him to do.
Right.
Because you mentioned Gog and Magog. He said there will be wars and rumors of wars.
Right.
Which I think is a reference to Ezekiel's war.
Mm-hmm.
But in Isaiah and the other things, we have, will there be any faith? So I think that the condition of the world, as we see it, the condition of believers, is as much a sign of his imminent coming as the prophetic signs of his imminent coming.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did find three things that seem to be pretty common throughout the Jewish writings, and they all believe that these things have to be accomplished by the Messiah and could possibly lead to why they didn't accept Yeshua when he came. And some of them you guys have already hit on when I asked what has to happen before the Messiah comes. But one of them is that they stated, and then they give the verses in the Old Testament to back it up. And I went and read them all just to make sure it wasn't twisting anything, and it's spot on. It says, the Mashiach will bring about the political and spiritual redemption of the Jewish people. And that's the only twist that they made on it, because it really says Israelite people. Outside of Israel, it will bring them back to Israel, restoring Jerusalem. So I thought with that one, anybody want to open their Bibles and read these? We've got one, is Isaiah 11.
I've been trying to, yeah.
11 through 14.
Yeah.
And then if somebody wants to turn to Jeremiah, they can read next. And then Hosea 3:4.
What's Jeremiah?
Jeremiah 33.
Okay.
Do you want to read that one,
yeah,
Christiana?
So Isaiah 11.
Yeah, and then if you had something to say about it, go ahead too.
Well, I mean, because we're talking about what is going to happen before he comes, or what is yet to be fulfilled, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we know that the false one's coming first. Mm-hmm. You know, we're,
right.
I mean, yeah, he's going to deceive. And I think one of the biggest things that we'll know that, I mean, I think it's going to be really plain when Messiah comes, it's going to be because the word already says that when he splits that sky, everyone's going to see him.
Yeah.
There's no questioning who's coming through the clouds with the heavens,
right,
the army of heaven behind him. Because he's coming to gather his people. And I don't know if the gathering's going to happen before his coming. You know, like here in Isaiah 11. Where do you want me to start reading?
I just wanted you to read 11 through 14. If you want to add to that, you can.
11, 14?
11, chapter 11,
right.
Verse 11 through 14.
Okay, that's, yeah. All right, and it says, let me go up to 10. In the day, the heir of David's throne will be a banner of salvation to all the world. The nations will rally to him, for the land where he lives will be a glorious place. In that day, the Lord will bring back a remnant of his people for the second time, returning them to the land of Israel from Assyria, Lower Egypt, Upper Egypt, Ethiopia, all those. Okay. He will raise a flag among the nations for Israel to rally around. He will gather the scattered people of Judah from the ends of the earth. Then at last, the jealousy between Israel and Judah will end. They will not fight each other anymore. They will join forces to swoop down on Philistia to the west. Together they will attack and plunder the nations to the east. They will occupy all the lands of Edom, Moab, and Ammon.
Yeah. So there you have a... When they say all the lands of Edom, Moab, and is it Ammon? Or, we can't say for sure, but that could be the fulfillment of the original land that was prophesied to Abraham. The original borders that they were prophesied. But they realize that this is only going to happen when the Messiah comes. So perhaps because Yeshua didn't fulfill that when he came the first time around, that's cause for them. And that leads into your question, Laura, is if they're still having faith in the Messiah of God, it's just way over my pay grade, but it's definitely a question worth pondering. Because who more likely to be received by Yeshua on Judgment Day than someone who's placed their entire faith in the Scriptures, lived a life the best they can according to the Word, put their faith in salvation from God, or a group of people that recognize Jesus as the Messiah, but has chosen to live a life that doesn't look anything like his. I mean, it's just, I'm saying, it's I'm glad it's way over my pay grade, and I'm a firm believer, despite what many people might think of the way I teach about church and all that, I'm a firm believer we will have Episcopalians. We'll have people from all walks of life, but they're people that have a heart after God and that love his scriptures and desire him. And for us to decide who that is, it's ridiculous. All we can do is try to encourage our brothers and sisters. Who had the next reading? Jeremiah 30, verse 3.
For look, the days are coming, declares Yahweh, when I shall turn back the captivity of my people Israel and Yehudah, declares Yahweh, and I shall bring them back to the land that I gave to their fathers to let them possess it. Now that's quoting Deuteronomy 30.
Yeah.
That's exact.
Yep. And we read both of those. Well, actually, we didn't read Jeremiah the other day. We did read Deuteronomy, though.
What was the scripture?
Jeremiah 33, what?
30, verse 3.
It was 30, verse 3?
30, verse 3, yep. And how about Hosea 3, 4? Who has that one?
I got it.
You got it? Okay.
For the children of Israel shall abide many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, without ephod or teraphim.
And it's, verse 5, I apologize.
Afterward, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. They shall fear the Lord and his goodness in the later days.
So those were the three places that they used to establish their thought that of what the Messiah was going to do when he returned. That was one of the statements, right? The other one was, he will establish a Torah government in Israel that will be the center of all world government, both for Jews and Gentiles. And we kind of read that a little bit in one of those scriptures. But they use Isaiah chapter 2 for the primary. Isaiah 2, Isaiah 11, Isaiah 42. Isaiah gets a lot of play in this. Studying the book of Isaiah, and I think, Ted, you studied it not too long ago. You were telling me how amazing it was when you're studying it with a Torah perspective.
Yeah, you know? all of the prophets.
Yeah.
Did somebody read 30? Did Jeremiah?
Yeah, Jeremiah 33. Yeah, somebody read that one.
Yeah, I'm looking at it in a different version.
Yeah. You can reread it. We can listen to it again.
I like from the beginning. This word came to, from Adonai. Huh? This is what Adonai, the God of Israel, says. Write all the words I have spoken to you in a scroll. For the day is coming, says Adonai, when I will reverse the exile of my people, Israel and Judah, says Adonai. I will cause them to return to the land I gave their ancestors, and they will take possession of it. Hasn't happened.
That's right.
Hasn't happened yet. And until Judah, and that other, the one you did in Isaiah, where there were, and again, I've got a Jewish version here, but when they talk about Judah no longer despising Israel,
yeah,
you know, well, that hasn't happened.
I know.
You know? When we see those things, mm-hmm. I think that's something to watch for.
Yeah.
So is that going to happen at his return once he's here? Because when you read like Isaiah 2, let me just read this.
I was going to ask somebody to read
Isaiah
it anyway.
Starting at 2:2.
Yeah, 2:2-4.
And I'll read it in the King James. And it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all the nations shall flow into it, And many people shall go and say, Come ye, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of God of Jacob, and he will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. So he's got to be here and already be established.
Yeah, that's their basis of believing that he will establish a Torah government, and they're absolutely correct. Most of the world doesn't think that, though. They think when Jesus comes back, we're going to be playing harps and multiple other stuff. I'll just leave it at that. They don't see these prophecies. And I think it's pretty profound of what's going to happen. I mean, the Torah is going to be our constitution again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And despite what people believe, I mean, there are going to be rebellion. There's going to be rebellion in the millennium. It wouldn't talk about the fact that it'll be a curse if they don't come up for the Feast of Tabernacles, if there's not going to be some people who reject the Messiah. And if at the very end we have this great war between Satan after the 1,000 years, there has to be some form of rebellion for Satan to muster up these people. So it's just my personal belief, because I don't think in the Bible it's written clearly, but I don't think in the millennium is a time where, I think we're still going to have our free will. We're still going to have to choose to wake up each morning and follow the Messiah. Now, I do believe it'll be much easier to follow the instructions when we're living in an area or a land or the whole world where Torah is the law, Sabbath is kept, we don't have to worry about the temptations and the pulls. But it's still going to be free will.
And I agree with the idea that, and I'm trying to remember the scripture, it talks about his enemies at the end of the 1,000 years are going to be cast into a lake of fire. Well, yeah, so in my mind, yeah, there's still going to be rebellion, you know, through the 1,000 years.
I figure if there was rebellion the first time he came, it's inevitable, as long as we have free will, that there's going to be rebellion a second time. Does that make sense?
Tom, is there any scripture that says that the false one is going to try to do the same thing? Trying to regather?
We know when Satan's let loose after the 1,000-year period, then he's going to be regathering people, and we have that final battle that we talk about. And that's right before the very end of Revelation, when we have the new heaven and earth coming down out of heaven. And
it says that
I'm talking
about makes peace, right? Though it doesn't it say that they
you're talking about during the tribulation
period?
Yeah,
I'm talking about leading up to his return. Will he try to mimic this? I mean, do we have any scriptures that he's going to try to mimic that?
There's a it does say that they'll be performing signs and wonders. The false prophet and the image itself, the image that he created, will speak. So this, whatever it is, statue, whatever it is, will be speaking and will have the ability as a non-human being to perform miracles. Does anybody remember the scriptures that talk about that?
That's what I'm looking for.
It will give power to the image to speak and to deceive the nation, deceive the people.
He'll be in Jerusalem, right? Won't he be in Jerusalem?
It says he will set foot in the holy nation.
Could I clarify? Could you clarify exactly what was your question?
Well, because I know we're talking about, you know, what the prophets are looking for in the Messiah. Well, I want to take it prior to the Messiah's return, because we know the false one, Antichrist, whatever you want to call him, he's coming on the scene, and he's going to deceive many. He's going to have power and do miracles and all that. And I just asked, is there anything in Scripture that where it says that he's going to try to fabricate the gathering of the people, you know, the scattered people all abroad and bring them back?
Yeah.
Because I think he is in Jerusalem. I mean,
there's a lot of people say,
I know Marcus talked about, I don't know if he wants to say anything, but I know that he has talked about that to me, that very, what she said.
Really? Okay.
I was crunching.
About a false going to,
does it say, right, if it could read, I just read Revelation 13.
Yeah, go ahead and read that part.
About what the potential, fulfillment of that, only because now we know that some of this has historical fulfillment, and some of this has fulfillment in the intimate side of this. And I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, on his horns ten crowns, on his heads names of blasphemy. And the beast I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him power, and his throne in great authority. And I saw on one of his heads having been slain to death, his deadly wound was healed, and all the earth marveled at the beast. They worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like the beast, who is able to fight with him? He was given a mouth speaking great matters and blasphemies, and he was given authority to do so 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemies against Elohim to blaspheme his name and his tent and those dwelling in the heavens. It was given to him to fight with the set apart ones and to overcome them. And authority was given to him over every tribe and tongue and nation. And all those dwelling on the earth whose names have not been written in the book of life and the slain lamb from the foundations of the world shall worship him. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. He who brings into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword has to be killed with the sword. Here is the endurance of the set apart, the belief of the set apart ones. And I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. And he exercises all authority of the first beast in his presence, and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. And he does great signs, so that even making fire come down from the heavens on the earth before men. And he leads astray those dwelling on the earth because of those signs which he has given to do before the beast, saying to those dwelling on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword yet lived. And there was given to him to give spirit to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause to be killed as many as would not worship the image of the beast. And he caused all, both great and small, rich and poor, free and slave, to be given a mark upon their hand or upon their foreheads, and they should be able to buy or sell. He said, he has that mark, the name of the beast, the number of his name. And then he goes into nothing.
So the image is created and it's given the ability to speak and to kill people who are not worshiping the beast. So, I mean, it's pretty weird stuff. But to answer your question, there is a prophecy in Daniel that regarding the anti-Messiah and what he will do. The one in Matthew talks about when you see the anti-Messiah standing in the holy place. Well, the word that's used in Greek means land. It doesn't mean that he can't come to Jerusalem and be at the temple. That's possible. But that's not what that word means. That's why I think when we get if we ever get a real original translation, that would be nice. But in Daniel, it definitely talks about standing in the temple, in the holy place. So it's very likely that he could do some of this. As far as the gathering, I mean, I don't know what you guys think, but it would be far more plausible for me, and this is something for discussion, that the anti-Messiah would try to do a false fulfillment of what the vast majority of people have taught Jesus is going to do when he comes back versus what's in the prophets, because so few people really study the prophets as a whole. Does that make sense? I mean, you might have 2 billion people on this planet that claim some form of Christianity, but how many of them study the prophets? A very small number. But yet the mainstream thought of what Jesus is going to do when he comes back, he may try to imitate that. Like, he may come back and say, it's okay, let's order some pork pizza, you know? Let's be unclean. It's all about love. It has nothing to do with this. This was done away with on the cross. I think Steve Berkson did an excellent teaching on that. And it's a very plausible possibility. We can't prove, but it's something we need to be paying attention for, because the bottom line is, it says the elect could be deceived if that were possible.
Is this guy going to acknowledge the Father?
That I don't think will happen. Yes. Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah. You know, but the whole...
Is he going to acknowledge God? Yeah.
The one thing, and I'll just share this. Did you guys see that couple that came last night that sat with me there? They were from a church I was at 10, 11 years ago. Really nice, sweet couple. And they have been having the Father pull them for 3 or 4 years. And he is a minister who went to seminary. And he's wondering why the church is in the state it's in. And what he says to me, I've always wondered why the entire church worships Jesus, but they don't know anything about the Father. Now, this is coming from a pastor. Now, he's not currently employed as a pastor, but, and this is, it's a hard balance to walk this line, because in no way should we disrespect Yeshua. We should love him and thank him for what he did, but he pointed us to the Father. So the vast majority of the people that I've had been able to spend time with don't know anything about the Father. In fact, my question 8 years ago to my wife was, why does Jesus look so much different than this Old Testament guy, the Father? I couldn't put it together. I was confounded. So, anybody else? Mark?
I'd like to kind of do a little spin off of what, instead of what he looks like. here's a question. If or when the Messiah comes back, what's his name going to be? Does anybody know? Jesus? Is it going to be Yeshua?
Yeah,
how are we going to recognize him?
Yeah,
because the name, in scriptures, names are really important because they mean what, they're describers. Mm-hmm. So what was Yeshua? What does that mean?
God's salvation.
Yeah, and that fits the first part of Isaiah 61.
Right.
And that's where Yeshua stopped.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's what his name meant. What is that? But it says in Revelation 3, I will write on him the name of my Elohim and the name of my God city, the new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from my Elohim, and my own new name. That's in 3:12. And my own new name. Those who have ears, let them hear what the Spirit is saying to the Messianic community.
Yep.
So, if he's going to have a new name, what would that name mean? I mean, this is all conjecture right now, but there's going to be people looking for somebody that's name is Jesus, or somebody that's name is Yeshua. And that could be one tip-off for the anti-Messiah.
Yeah.
Instead of what does he look like, what's his name going to be?
Yeah.
So, what's he going to do as he follows through Isaiah 61, you know, the part that he didn't read, a name that's going to match that, a name that's going to match some of these other prophecies. Because when we read in the Hebrew, Yeshua-ti is written in verb form all over the place. Mm-hmm. And there's a few people that are actually named Yahshua,
yeah,
or Hosea. So I don't know Hebrew enough to know what other verb may be splattered all over that's going to be part of his new name.
That's a really good point.
Mark, I just came in late. Apologies.
Oh, this is.
Oh no.
This is David. And he's our
David, welcome.
Well, I want to be sort of officially soon. God willing. It's interesting because you have a type and shadow of Moses, Joshua, that entire instance, type and shadow of what's to come. And Joshua is renamed.
Mm-hmm.
And does anybody recall what his name meant before it was Joshua?
It was Hosea.
Yes, which means.
No, it. And he, no, please share with us.
It means how salvation from man.
Salvation from man, okay.
Or salvation
he
of man.
He is salvation, which
right.
Refers
okay.
to himself. And then he changed his name after he was one of the spies that came back with a good report
right.
to Joshua. And Joshua means salvation from God, which is an interesting type
yeah.
of shadow.
That's true, yeah.
And so when you take a look at what Shua's name means, what does it mean?
God's salvation.
Yeah. So it's interesting because how many names does God have in the Old Testament? And there's all sorts of, I've traveled around quite a bit now, and there's a whole bunch of argument and conflict that arises over what's his name. Well, if you, it's hundreds. There are hundreds of types and forms of his name in the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. And if you said any one of them, you would be correct. Mm-hmm. And that being said, why do we have to make God so finite and so small when all of those names are types of his function, which is exactly what you're referring to? The name of Yeshua is his function. And the name of his name that will be revealed when the end times come will be his function. Mm-hmm. And do you think it's any wonder that why was it hidden? It's hidden so that only the people who know his character will actually know what his name is.
That's true, yeah. Good point. Real good.
It's